Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Liberal activist, journalist, and writer Naomi Klein is all about resisting President Donald Trump. Working class voters who went for Trump are in for a rude awakening, she says. The Trump presidency, she says, is the culmination of a long corporate takeover of American politics. Resisting is not enough, says Naomi Klein. It's time to see and prepare. This hour on Point, Naomi Klein on the presidency of Donald Trump and what comes after. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is the right response to Donald Trump and his politics? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will check in on the weekend's anti-Sharia and anti-anti-Sharia protests across the country. But joining me now from New York is Naomi Klein, columnist, documentary filmmaker, journalist, senior correspondent for The Intercept. Her new book is called No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Naomi Klein, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's great to be with you.
You say this is the culmination of a half century of political evolution in this country. The culmination in what way, Donald Trump's presidency? Of what?
Well, one of the things it's a culmination of is really the merger of the corporate and political worlds, the revolving door. But this really represents just taking out that door and making it one big room, or in some ways, it's like firing the middleman. You know what they say about if you want a job done well, do it yourself, right? So now we have a fully commercialized brand as a president, the former CEO of Exxon, as Secretary of State, five former Goldman Sachs executives in the cabinet, a lot of people coming straight from weapons companies to work in defense. And it's just there's no pretext of any intermediary between the corporate world and governing. And this is, you know, not something new that was invented by Trump. I mean, we can think about Dick Cheney going straight from Halliburton and then Halliburton getting the most lucrative contracts of the Iraq War. But just the extent of it, the unmasked nature of it, the impunity of it, like, what are you going to do about it? Just today, we're hearing news of a new lawsuit, more significant than the previous ones, because it's coming from the attorney generals of D.C. and Maryland, that the president may actually be violating the Constitution in the kind of self-enrichment that seems to be going on, the merger, really, of the Trump Organization, the Trump brand, and the U.S. government.
Is this a moment for the left or the center? I mean, I know where you're coming from. I know what you'll say, but we've seen all kinds of different reactions. I mean, we saw in France recently, after a time of turmoil and voter unrest, they've gone very strongly to, it looks like, toward the center with Emmanuel Macron. England, Labour has come on strong in the last election, though Theresa May is still in there at the moment as prime minister. In the U.S., I mean, you are strongly out of the left and progressive politics. How do you see this playing out both in resistance and in the aftermath, which you're focused on in this book, for progressive politics?
Well, I think it is much more of an economic populist message that is going to be able to take on this sort of self-dealing and self-enrichment. You know, I think if it is possible to peel away some of Trump's voters, particularly those that voted for Obama in 2012 and 2008, it's less going to be about Comey and Russia and, some sense that Trump is committing gaffe after gaffe on the international stage by shaking leaders' hands for too long. I mean, that's not going to be what's going to appeal to those voters or really leave them to lead Trump. It's going to be exposing that despite having run as this savior of the working class with this message, you know, I'm so rich, I don't need any more money. I understand how the corruption works because I have made it work for me, but now I'm going to make it work for you. And yet, while so many of us are just focused on what I would broadly call the Trump show, which is, you know, this endless distraction and sort of series of shocks that are going off, some of it created by Trump, some of it inflicted on Trump because of his incompetence or his avarice, depending on the scandal. But while we're focused on that, you have this very methodical transfer of wealth that is going on with all of Trump's economic policies, from his tax policies to his healthcare plans, his entire budget, his attacks on regulations. I mean, all the pattern is very, very clear. This is enriching the already rich. So I think it is an economic populist message with a credible messenger. I think the Democrats lacked that in the last election campaign because we saw how Trump painted Hillary Clinton as a tool of the billionaires. Obviously, we know that to be a tremendous irony. It was ironic before, but it's especially ironic now that we see all the Goldman Sachs executives that he's introduced after attacking her for being too close to Goldman Sachs.
Now they're actually on the cabinet.
Exactly. So she's, but the problem is she wasn't a credible messenger for any kind of economic populist message because, you know, through the Clinton Foundation, the Clintons had been part of annihilating those boundaries between the very, very wealthy and the political class. You know, they kind of threw the party, to be honest.
You know, this dramatic migration of wealth in this country and the huge income and wealth gap that has opened up has occurred under both Republican and Democratic administrations for a long time now. What's different about the Trump administration, in your view, Naomi Klein?
Well, I just think it's the shamelessness. It's the, you know, what are you going to do about it? Defiance behind it, right? Of not releasing tax returns, of just kind of laughing off whether or not he's violating the Constitution. So I see this as a continuum. I think Trump in so many ways, not as an aberration, but just taking current trends to their logical conclusion. And as you say, this has been an absolutely bipartisan process. This is not a partisan issue, but in thinking about how to counter it, no, I don't think the solution is a Macron-type figure from France, who is himself a former banker, who in his previous position in the Hollande government was the face of austerity. What my concern is, I think France is lagging behind the U.S. in this sort of timeline, in that if after 4 or 5 years of austerity as usual in France, I think there would be a tremendous risk of a Marine Le Pen surge. So the idea that the U.S. should learn from France, I think, has it backwards. I think that Democrats should look at what just happened with Jeremy Corbyn in the U.K., who did much better than anyone predicted. And their turning point was coming out with a very bold platform, an ideas-based vision, which was ultimately about redistributing wealth and about taking on wealth inequality, rebuilding the healthcare system, the education system, tangible benefits for people that I think Hillary Clinton wasn't able to offer on the campaign trail. She was running on a negative campaign of, you know, don't vote for this terrible man. We stand for love. It was sort of, he was all is hell, she was all is well. And that did not resonate for people for whom all is not well.
Talk about what happened with the Trump rise to the presidency. From your point of view, progressive, liberal, you say Hillary Clinton was an imperfect leader or candidate. Okay, we got that point. But there's more here. I mean, you wrote the book on branding, no logo, way back when, 17 or 18 years ago now. The Shock Doctrine, your other big book. You talk a lot in this book, No Is Not Enough, about the Trump brand, and you're still very focused on shocks to the system. Give us your read on what brought Donald Trump to power.
So I do think that, we are in entirely new territory because it's not that there's never been a president who had business ties before, right? The issue is that he is a different kind of businessman. He is what I called in No Logo a hollow brand, right? He followed this recipe that companies like Nike and Apple adopted in the 90s, where it became sort of a passe to own your own factories or even to think of yourself as a product-based company. These were lifestyle branding companies that were selling transcendent ideas, identities. And the rise of these types of companies coincided with the Reagan political project and the continuation under Clinton, where many of the institutions where people were getting their communal identities, whether it was trade unions or organized religion, a lot of public institutions were being eroded, were in recession. And so people were getting their identities through shopping. And so Trump has been selling this identity, which is based on wealth. You're the rich boss, and with that wealth comes total impunity and total power. And this is why no scandal sticks to Trump. And, I think journalists keep trying to treat him as if he's going to play by the rules of politics, but he's still playing by the rules of corporate branding. And the rules of corporate branding are know your big idea. Extend that big idea onto as many surfaces as possible. Give people as many opportunities as possible to have an aspirational relationship with your brand and stay consistent, right? So on the campaign trail, he talks about how he could probably shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. He talks about he can grab women by the genitals and get away with it. That's his brand. And so there are labor scandals associated with his brand. There's, all of these questions about what laws he's violating, but he's getting away with it. He's still embodying his brand. The more he gets away with it, the more he embodies his brand.
So when does that run out, or does it?
Well, you can see the stuff that really drives him kind of nuts, like if you do President Bannon, or treat him like a puppet instead of a boss. He gets very upset about that because that is actually hitting him where it hurts. That his brand is being a boss. So if you paint him as a puppet, that hurts him. And of course, it hurts him if you hurt him in the wallet, right? There's a grab your wallet campaign, and that bothers them a lot because that's where it hurts.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
There's no conceivable justification
for blocking an actual investigation.
There's no conceivable justification.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Crowds near the Washington Monument last week, part of a demonstration calling for investigations into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. With us this hour, big liberal activist Naomi Klein, talking about resisting Donald Trump and what comes after. She says Donald Trump represents the complete corporate takeover of Washington. Of course, that trend, you could say, has been underway for some time. She says her new book is No is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need, joins us today from New York, and you can join us as well. What does the rise of Donald Trump say about where American politics have come? Are the suits we're just hearing about today out of Maryland and D.C. the way to rein Donald Trump in, set some boundaries? And if you're with Naomi Klein, progressive, left, what do you say to the millions of Americans who aren't or weren't in the November elections? Donald Trump promised a lot on the campaign trail. Here he was.
I will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created. I tell you that. I'll bring back our jobs from China, from Mexico, from Japan, from so many places. I'll bring back our jobs and I'll bring back our money.
He'll bring back jobs and money, and the president's people would say that's still what he's gunning for. Naomi Klein says, watch out. She joins us from New York. Neil McLean, you've written a lot about the shock doctrine. Remind us of your fundamental notion there and how you see that playing out or not playing out in the Trump administration.
So the shock doctrine refers to a tactic that we have seen repeat again and again. And that tactic is the harnessing of large-scale crises, of large-scale shocks to the system, maybe an economic crisis or a Hurricane Katrina or a 9/11, and the disorientation, the dislocation, the panic, the need to focus on daily emergencies, to use that window that opens up in the aftermath of crisis to push through very unpopular pro-corporate policies. We saw it after Katrina with the privatization of New Orleans school system. We saw it with the economic crisis in 2008 when that crisis, which was created by the banks, the price for it, the price tag was offloaded onto the people who were least responsible. And this was particularly true in Europe, where there's just been years and years of quite brutal austerity and privatizations, attacks on wages, to pay for that crisis. And this is the moment we're in now, where, you know, I think it is a moment of populism on both the right and the left, because I don't think we have recovered from that shock. So my concern with Trump is he's kind of a rolling shock. He generates shocks himself deliberately, and you know, through his incompetence and avarice. We're all focused on that Trump show. And meanwhile, we're seeing a very radical pro-corporate agenda being pushed through with the help of some five former Goldman Sachs executives in his cabinet. 15% flat tax, getting rid of the estate tax, throwing 23 million people off of healthcare coverage. Even his climate policies enrich or have the potential to enrich a significant sector of the U.S. economy that is very powerful within his administration, the oil and gas industry. But what really keeps me up at night, to be honest, and why I wrote this book a lot faster than I've written my previous books, it usually takes me about 5 years, and this one came out, 5 months after I started it, is because I'm really worried about what would happen if there is a major external shock, like, God forbid, what happened in London or Manchester or Paris in 2015 with the simultaneous attacks. We already saw how ready President Trump was to take advantage of the London attacks, to say, this is why I need my Muslim travel ban. In France, after those attacks, the president declared a state of emergency, which banned political protests. So when we think about the protests that emerged in the face of the Muslim travel ban, well, I think in the aftermath of an attack like that, they would call those protests a threat to national security. I think we'd see the much more radical parts of the Trump agenda, which are still lying in wait, to be honest.
Like what you fear?
I fear that there's open talk about internment camps on Fox News these days.
Internment of whom?
Well, Muslim internment. I mean, this is what was talked about after the London attacks, as if this is a serious possibility. And it's very important, if you want to be shock resistant, to know your history, to know that in the United States, in the aftermath of traumatic events like Pearl Harbor, that is when people's rights are stripped of them. That is when 120,000 Japanese Americans were incarcerated in internment camps, or during the Great Depression, hundreds of thousands of Mexican Americans were deported. So moments of crisis are moments when people lose their rights if they are not extremely vigilant. So, I wanted to, put out these warnings, an economic crisis as well, that right now they're in the middle of dismantling Dodd-Frank, which makes it more likely that there will be another market shock, right? You inflate bubbles, they burst. And then that becomes the pretext, potentially, to dismantle Social Security, which is something that Trump promised he would not do on the campaign trail. So I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I'm saying it would be very, very unwise not to prepare.
You say resistance is not enough. I mean, the very name of your book is No is Not Enough. And you write a lot about readiness for a further wave of kind of a shock and change. Granted that this is something that Trump's camp supports openly. I mean, Kellyanne Conway's talked about shock therapy for the country, and you've got a lot of Americans who voted for him saying, we want to turn the tables over a little bit here. But for those who may not want the Trump-style change, you say resistance isn't enough. You've got to be ready. What does readiness mean?
Well, I think part of it is just understanding these tactics, because they don't work as well if you're not shocked by them. The whole point is to take people by surprise before, you know, they can get organized. But you know, I think there was a very strong resistance after the 2008 financial crisis to the austerity policies. You know, in this country, we saw Occupy Wall Street. In Europe, you had huge movements occupying squares, you know, in Spain, in Greece, in Italy. But it was this resounding no, we won't pay for your crisis. There was not, in what I argue in the book, enough of a yes, enough of a program for what kind of economy do we want instead? How are we going to fix the economy in credible ways that are going to excite people? And, you know, coming back to what just happened in the UK, I think what we saw with the Corbyn campaign is what can happen when you put forward an inspiring yes that speaks to people's better selves, to their real hopes and dreams, and not just a no, not just an opposition. So you know, I think I'm not saying we should not resist the toxic nature of what's coming at us. We have to say no, but that can't be the end of it. There has to be a yes that is the flip side of it, a real plan, because I think the past 40 years, there has been a crisis of progressive imagination, and part of that has just been the messaging of there. You know, ever since Thatcher, there is no alternative, and there hasn't been the necessary courage to put forward that bold alternative. But I do think that is changing.
A lot of talk about alternatives over the weekend at this Bernie Sanders talking in Chicago. This was on Saturday at the what was called the People's Summit convention there. And Bernie Sanders calling on progressive activists to change or change their loyalty from the Democratic Party. Here he was.
The current model and the current strategy of the Democratic Party is an absolute failure. The Democratic Party needs fundamental change. What it needs is to open up its doors to working people and young people and all people who are prepared to fight for social and economic justice. The Democratic Party must finally understand which side it is on.
Bernie Sanders, just this weekend in Chicago. Naomi Klein, what's your vision of yes? Say yes to what?
I was in the room for that speech and at the summit all weekend. You know, my vision for yes starts from the premise that we live in a time of multiple overlapping crises, a crisis of deepening inequality, a crisis of racial injustice, which is just getting more and more severe under Trump with this with the recent marches, the latest example of that, and hate crimes, and also on top of that, on top of all of it, the crisis of climate change. All of these are demanding a bold response. So what I lay out in the book is some examples of, you know, what is increasingly being called intersectional politics. How do we solve multiple problems at once? How do we change our economy so that we're getting to 100% renewables, but we're making it a fair economy at the same time? So communities could own and control their own renewable energy projects, and we would design policies so that the communities that have gotten the worst deal under the current fossil fuel model have, where their kids have the highest asthma rates, where their cancer clusters in their communities would be first in line to own and control their own renewable energy projects.
You want to let market economics go to some significant extent, from as I read you. Is that true?
Well, look, I do think that when you're faced with this level of crisis, that we can't leave it to the invisible hand. It does take planning. I mean, especially when it comes to climate change, you know, we need to change very, very quickly. We have procrastinated in the face of this problem now for more than a quarter of a century. So now we are out of time. We need to get to 100% renewable energy before mid-century. That is a dramatic change to how we power our lives, how we move ourselves around, how we design our cities. yes, we have to intervene in the market. And I think the moment we're in now, where you see this extraordinary support among young people, millennials, for candidates like Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn, who are talking about a more managed economy where we grow in the areas that are that are improving people's quality of life, the care economy, teaching, education, the green economy, but we do contract those parts of our economy that are putting our planet and people in danger, that it's young people who are lining up behind these candidates. And I think it's because they saw how selectively the rules of capitalism are applied in this formative moment in their lives, just as they are becoming politically aware. The 2008 financial crisis happens. They see that trillions of dollars can be marshaled to save the banks. They see that it's possible to intervene in the market if you are rich enough. And so they're saying, well, why can't we do the same thing to give people health care and education? So this is a very different generation than my generation, which really grew up in the full indoctrination of, you know, government is always the problem. It's never the solution, to quote Reagan.
Naomi Klein's new book is No Is Not Enough. Joan C. Williams joins us in a moment. She's been looking at the American working class and what they've called for from the ballot box. Couple calls here. Mary in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I am a resistor. I voted for Bernie. I guess my question is, what else can we do besides being prepared and reading your book? So I look forward to that. And I thank your guest. We need to wake up America, listen to experts like, you know, John's show, On Point, educate ourselves. We can't listen and dwell, you know, on the fake news, the tweets of what I call the Lion King. Maxine Waters is a Democrat from the L.A. area. She is a representative there, and she was on Tavis Smiley, another wonderful show that has a lot of insight. And she kind of succinctly put it where most of the appointees of 45 are connected with Russia, the Kremlin, and so on. And their point is to de-sanction drilling in the Arctic. And he became president to make more money for his cronies and himself, not to help America.
Mary, we've got it. Let me get a couple more calls right here. I appreciate yours from Wisconsin. Let's get one from Maryland, where we've got this new suit coming today against the president. Jessica's calling from Baltimore. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling in regards to the other side of the aisle, so to speak. I'm not a conservative. I'm quite centrist. But from what I've been hearing, it's all talk about Trump's a racist and how so and so is a racist. Everybody's racist if you dare criticize somebody else. Like, I have heard things that would shock the other side. Genital mutilation, they're trying to pass that female genital mutilation in Maine as part of religious freedom. Evergreen State, minorities are...
What's your big point here, Jessica? I'm trying to hear it. What's your main point?
Before you start judging the other side, why can't you start judging your side first?
You're saying to Naomi Klein, look at the left and its own issues? Naomi, take it where you will.
Well, I didn't hear anything there that is actually associated with my side. But you know, I certainly agree that there needs to be self-criticism for why the Democrats lost the election, and even why a candidate like Bernie Sanders, who I did support, wasn't able to gain more votes. You know, what I said when I spoke at the People's Summit was, you know, if we don't think Hillary Clinton should just be able to blame Russia for her defeat, then we can't just blame the DNC for Bernie's defeat. You know, if Bernie had a message that connected more with voters of color, particularly older Black and Latino voters, because, you know, he did well with millennials, across the board. If he had been able to connect more with older women voters who saw their reproductive freedoms as being much more fragile and open to being rolled back, there were a lot of people who felt that his treatment of so-called identity politics were a bit of an add-on. You know, I think he got better as the campaign went on. I think there is a progressive majority out there. And the reason why the Democrats lost is because they were not able to energize their base with an offer, with a vision that connected with enough people. And that is really the task. I think it's very important to engage, for everybody to engage in self-criticism, to not just harden into the finger-pointing, which is amazing. I mean, it's amazing how the discussions online are still acting as if we remain in the primaries, you know? So I think that's quite destructive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with big liberal activist, journalist, writer Naomi Klein about resisting Donald Trump and what comes after. Her new book is No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. She joins us today from New York, author of The Shock Doctrine, No Logo, and more. A little later in this hour, lots of marches and protests and demonstrations over the weekend, a big gay pride weekend and equality weekend, but also big anti-Sharia protests in a number of cities, across a couple of dozen across the country. We'll look at those. Right now, Joan C. Williams joins us from San Francisco. She's been listening. She's a professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Wrote an article for the Harvard Business Review, What So Many People Don't Get About the U.S. Working Class. Lots of people went to read that. Author of White Working Class. She's been casting a critical eye on a lot of progressive analysis of what's going on in this country, in particular progressive politics and how they do or don't appeal to some members of the American working class, some members who may have voted for Donald Trump. Joan Williams, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
What do you hear in Naomi Klein's call? First for resistance and then for a new path for progressives as a way back into power and influence in this country with a different vision.
Well, there's a lot I agree with. I'm a progressive, too. But I think one of the things that's important is that our problems go much deeper than Trump. We just had 8 years of a Democratic administration that could accomplish very little because we couldn't keep the House. And Democrats have been pursuing what I call a blue coasts and blue dots strategy. Those are the areas that vote Democratic, and ignoring the oceans of largely rural red in between. And that is just not working for us. I think that's one important difference. The other is, although I think that Naomi Klein gives really astute analysis of how to undermine Trump, direct attacks on Trump risk strengthening him. One Ohio
so?
Voter said, we voted with our middle finger. Naomi is really right. If we do nothing but attack Trump, it just plays into his hands, because that just proves that he is standing up to the elites, that the elites hate him. And the other thing she's right about is this, that we need a positive message. And she's also right about what message we need. The white working class, like so many working class people of color and low-income people, all they want is what the elites already have, which is a job that yields their vision of a middle-class life. That should be the core progressive, whether you're Democratic or a Bernie voter. That's what people want.
If Donald Trump was able to win that vote, that Ohio voter who voted with their middle finger, with his message, what does that say about progressives' opportunity for winning that vote? Because the message is very different here, almost
opposite. We weren't talking
opposite.
About jobs. We were talking about everything. I mean, jobs was number 73 on a 300-item party platform. You had a perfect excerpt from Trump saying, vote for me, I will give you jobs. Now, I don't believe he's going to give them jobs, but I believe we have to be saying to Trump voters, he's offering you fake jobs. We're offering you a real jobs program. I think that's what would be very attractive to them.
Naomi says intersectional politics is the way to go. Does that fly?
Well, I mean, I like Naomi, I'm an identity politics person. That just means I'm interested in race and gender as well as class and other issues. So I don't think we need to get beyond identity politics. I think all politics is about identity. But I do think that the Democrats and progressives have for too long ignored and indeed derided the white working class. There's a long history, unfortunately, of treating them like stupid, dim-witted Homer Simpsons just being duped by the wily business elites. These are intelligent people, and as Naomi has pointed out, the reason they voted for Trump is that they feel equally disillusioned with Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, I agree with Naomi. Whose fault is that? We need to be talking to them. And not talking to them about a guaranteed annual income, which is inevitably going to be small. And by the way, we're not in Sweden. What they want, again, is what elites have, a job that delivers them a modest middle-class standard of living.
Joan, stand by. Naomi Get Klein back. Calls for the two of you. Alan in Brandon, Florida. Alan, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great.
I just wanted to respond to the comment that your guest Naomi said earlier concerning internment camps. I found that really offensive because, I mean, after 9/11, I don't believe there were any internment camps.
Nope.
Based off of that. So why is it any different now? Things are happening overseas against countries that are part of NATO. And, you know, I know Trump's had some arguments about Article 5, seeing about implementing that, which is his right as America being a member of NATO. And me being a former military member, an avid conservative, I just find that the guest is grossly fear-mongering what Trump is trying to do. And what a lot of people don't understand, especially the people on the Democratic aisle, is that, you know, me being over in Iraq and Afghanistan multiple times, I've witnessed suicide bombings, and they are not a great thing. And these people, you know, these Islamic extremists are just a very small percentage of the people that are very great in their own right.
Alan, our time is short. I appreciate your call. Naomi Klein, fear-mongering is the charge.
I didn't say there were internment camps after 9/11. I said there were internment camps.
No, you said they would. But Alan's saying if they didn't happen after 9/11, they're not going to happen in the future.
Look, I think we should take Trump at his word. He ran an election campaign saying he wanted to bar entry to the United States for all Muslims, that he wanted to profile an entire religion until, I think his phrase was, we get things this under control. That is precisely the kind of logic that leads to these extreme violations of human rights. And by the way, I think this is very related to what Joan has been talking about in terms of jobs. He made these very appealing promises about bringing the jobs back, bringing the good jobs back. You know, there is no evidence that he is going to be able to make good on that. A big part of his resonant message for working people was taking on these trade deals. But what we've learned is that his commerce secretary is reassuring business audiences that the way he wants to renegotiate NAFTA is to make it exactly like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would make NAFTA worse for workers. So they are going to renegotiate it, but they're going to make it worse for workers. So when they don't deliver on this grand jobs promises, it's going to become more important to kind of feed red meat to the base. And that is where I think we're going to see a further escalation of this divide and conquer race-based politics. And it will get more dangerous as they fail to deliver on the jobs.
Do you see Democrats?
Then they will feel like they have to deliver something. We've got to get that wall built. You know, how are we, you know, yeah, how are we going to reassure these voters and get them next
We just
time?
Got half a minute. Do you see Democrats or Bernie Sanders or you name it realigning in such a way as to counter that effectively at the polls, which is where the power ultimately lies?
I don't think we're there yet, frankly, in connecting the dots and telling a coherent story about how race has consistently been used as a wedge to push through policies that damage working people across the country.
Naomi Klein's new book is No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. She joins us from New York. Naomi, come back and talk to us more. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And Joan Williams in San Francisco, author of White Working Class. Joan, great to have you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
In a moment, we look at Saturday's anti-Sharia rallies around the country. This is On Point. It was a weekend of protest across the country. Hundreds of LGBT marches celebrated gay pride, marked today's one-year anniversary of the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, and pushed back on a president who campaigned as gay-friendly but has not shown those colors in the White House. Big marches all over. Meanwhile, there were some two dozen marches by right-wing groups against the Muslim Code of Sharia and protesters against those protesters. For more on the anti-Sharia protests, I'm joined by Abigail Hausloner. She's a national reporter for The Washington Post, joins me from the nation's capital. Abigail, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Who came out for these anti-Sharia protests? Who organized them in the first place?
Well, the protests were organized by a group called Act for America. They're formerly a real fringe group that has operated on sort of the far right for about 10 years now. They've helped launch a number of bills in state houses across the country to combat what they say is the growing threat of Sharia law. They've also, you know, tried to fight back against refugees and immigration to the United States, and they're very supportive of Trump. So they organized this rally as a march against Sharia, with the idea that Islamic law is encroaching on U.S. society.
And the turnout at the rallies, how many were there? Where were they largest? And what was the turnout like? Who came?
Well, it was pretty small. You saw, cities across the country, it was only a couple dozen in most places. In San Bernardino, California, where, you know, which is where we saw the 2015 terrorist attack, that saw the largest crowd of about 200 people. But for the most part, they were outnumbered, and they were outnumbered by rival protests, as you mentioned, by people who range from so-called anti-fascist groups and anarchists to labor organizers and interfaith activists.
Here's a little sound from Chicago. This was Saturday. One woman protesting against Sharia law, she said she fears is taking hold in the United States.
I have a fundamental human right to oppose an ideology that defines me, a non-Muslim woman, as an inhuman slave.
And here, another, a Muslim woman, Fatima, came out to protest the anti-Sharia demonstrations that took place this weekend in Syracuse, New York.
For us to be persecuted here in America, of all places, a safe haven for the original occupiers of this country, it's so not American.
And it got pretty messy in Seattle, Lansing, Michigan. Here to two of some dozen cities where the group Act for America held protests. In Seattle, fists and expletives were flying as the Act protesters met counter-protesters here. Abigail Hausloner is with us from The Washington Post. She's been covering this. Abigail, what exactly is driving this? Is there anywhere in this country that Sharia law is actively in place, or, you know, is this a real situation or is it fiction?
Well, that's obviously the center of the debate in these rallies, the counter rallies. There is no evidence that Sharia law is in place in any part of the country. What Sharia is, and a lot of these arguments are centered, around or sort of rooted in a general lack of understanding on all sides in the U.S. about what Sharia really is. It's a very broad code of essentially guidelines for how Muslims are meant to live their lives, and it includes, it governs everything from divorce to marriage to what to eat, how to bury the dead. And that what is often seized upon by groups such as Act for America are, what we know as the, really extreme forms of punishment that are outlined in Sharia, and that, those can include stoning, executions for various crimes. Now, Muslim leaders say that, there's a wider range of interpretations for Sharia, and, most Muslims are certainly law-abiding citizens and, do not subscribe to these you know, ideas of, you know, executions or you know, simply acting outside of U.S. law. But that's not what Act for America says. Act for America says that, in fact, you know, numbers of Muslims in the United States, and particularly refugees and immigrants, are trying to bring Sharia law in its worst forms into the United States and impose it in place of U.S. law.
That's not happening anywhere. I don't know who speaks up even for that. Is this an ideology? Is it an anti-Muslim movement at heart? What's driving the Act for America crowd?
Well, civil rights organizations certainly claim that it is an anti-Muslim movement. Act for America, you know, it tends to focus, a lot of these groups will focus on something like anti-Sharia, but they also make sweeping statements about Islam, the dangers of Islam. The leader of Act for America frequently says that all practicing Muslims, you know, actually embrace Sharia. So, you know, it's indicative of, I think, where sentiments towards Muslims are in this country right now. And I think it shows there's been this growing popularity of ideas that were one time considered fringe and largely dismissed, you know, by mainstream politics and by the vast majority of Americans. Those ideas are starting to find their way into the mainstream. And you're hearing, you know, a lot of myths, a lot of false claims being propagated more and more by ordinary Americans.
Well, is that true? I mean, when you look at what happened this weekend, as you say, pretty small turnout at a lot of these, much larger turnouts for many of the equality marches. Does it look like this is really taking hold? I mean, what do you take away from what actually transpired this weekend around the country, Abigail?
Well, I think if we're to look sort of exclusively at these marches and counter marches, we would certainly come away with the conclusion that, no, the vast majority of Americans, you know, are, you know, embracing tolerance and do not think that Muslims pose this sort of existential threat to America. But one thing that I noticed, I cover Islam in America. I travel around the country regularly. I talk to Muslims, but I also talk to people who are suspicious of or afraid of Muslims. And one thing that I've noticed increasingly is that people often mention some of the talking points that I hear from Act for America and that you see on Breitbart News, for example. Claims about Sharia, claims that refugees are, you know, carrying out acts of rape across the country, you know, claims that we know not to be true, I hear quite often from people as I travel.
Does Act for America see President Trump in their corner? Is he a guiding light for them?
Absolutely. The founder of Act for America, Brigitte Gabriel, regularly trumpets her group's ties to Trump. She tweeted earlier this year that she had a meeting at the White House, which we know to have been, it looks like a small meeting with an aide. She bragged that she was actually sitting near Trump having dinner at Mar-a-Lago.
Abigail, we're out of time right there, but we appreciate so much your time. Abigail Hauslohner with The Washington Post. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.